All right. Thank you. So guests and processes is something that I love to talk about. So so thanks for giving me this opportunity. Just before we start, who in here knows about Gaussian processes?
How much?
Yeah, have you heard of them before today? Yeah, that's good. And who has actually used them in their work? Okay, so a few people. Okay, so I'm hoping that that everything I talk about today will be useful regardless of sort of what your level of expertise is. I think there will probably even be a few things that are useful for, you know, the hardcore experts. But we're gonna try to start it pretty basic, and I've sort of structured it like a class, sort of. But I'm happy to answer questions throughout. So please interrupt me as things inevitably make absolutely no sense. Okay. So the first thing I wanted to do was just list a few resources at the beginning that can be useful for you after this, because I'll forget to do that later if I don't do that right now. So. And I'll refer to Gaussian processes as GPs all the time, so that's what it means. Gaussian processes are very popular in astro, but I don't really know of like a standard astro-specific text for GPs, even though they're so widely used. There is sort of the Bible of everything Gaussian process, which is a book called, I forget, something about Gaussian processes, machine learning, something, by Rasmussen and Williams. And you can just Google GPML book.
It's called Gaussian Processes for Machine Learning.
What he said. Excellent. And it's just freely available as a PDF online, and it's sort of the reference that everyone uses. It doesn't introduce things in the same language as we're familiar with as astronomers, so it can be a bit of a steep learning curve when you first pick it up, but once you sort of have the basics, it's sort of the classic text, and it's nice that it's freely available. So that's worth knowing about. So then there are lots of resources that I've written that I think are useful for astronomy specific things, because I'm thinking about this as an astronomer. One that I wrote a long time ago, but I think is pretty fun, but you know, it's old, so don't hold it against me, is something called gp.js, which is where I wrote a Gaussian process code in JavaScript that runs right in your browser, which is silly, but it lets you sort of interactively play with the parameters of your GP and get a qualitative sense for what Gaussian processes are all about. So that can be useful. I also have a tutorial on GitHub. At that URL that has a Jupyter notebook that you can sort of play with as cells for you to fill in and you know, things to play around with. Even if you're not super familiar with Python, it can still be a good way to get started with the ideas of Gaussian processes. So if you're keen, that's another good place. And then I have three Gaussian process Python packages that I've written. I don't know why I do this to myself. Called George, Celerite, and Exoplanet. And you can find all of those on GitHub as well. And there's extensive documentation with each of those that have tutorials for applying Gaussian processes in astronomical contexts. So those can be useful too. I'm sure there are lots of other very useful resources, but it's me giving this talk, and so here we go. These are the ones that I recommend highly. I'm around for the next month and a half, so if you're interested in working on Gaussian processes, I would love to chat about your specific use case. I also like to answer emails sometimes. Okay, so those are our resources. So now I want to actually start explaining what Gaussian process and we're going to start at the beginning, which is where we want to fit a model to data. And there's going to be a few steps here before we get to Gaussian processes, so just bear with me. I promise we'll get there eventually, okay? So given that I'm here participating in the ExoStar workshop, I'm going to say that I have some data that look like this. I have flux as a function of time, and I might have a little dip in the center of this that is perhaps a transiting planet. And throughout this tutorial, I'm going to focus on time series analysis type problems like this. For sure, some of the things I talk about are more generally applicable, but it's useful to have a concrete use case like this in mind as we're going forward. And everything's a lot simpler in 1D, like a time series like this. So we'll mostly focus on that today. Okay, so I have some data that look like that. I want to fit a model to those data. Eric isn't here yet, but thanks to Eric Egel, we know how to compute what a model would look like for these data. It might look something like that. It's a transiting planet. We've got geometry and limb darkening and all that kind of stuff going on. And so this, I'm going to call my mean model. And the idea is that we have some function that has some parameters theta, speak of the devil, that gives you the value, the expected value of the flux as a function of time. And it has some parameters theta, which are going to be things like, you know, the orbital period of your planet, the radius ratio, those kinds of things. So there, yeah. So we have some model, and we know how to compute the expected value for the flux at some time. So then, so that's not everything. That just having that doesn't give us a way of fitting a model to data. There's a second thing that we need, and that's because you can see there are error bars right here, and the points don't lie exactly on top of the line. They're pretty close. I might have overestimated my error bars here, but you know. And so what you also need is a noise model. And when I say noise model, I mean some probability distribution for some observed value of y given the expected value of y. So this is observed. And this is expected. All right, and then this, so sort of a fairly common probability distribution to assume here would be a Gaussian, where you have some error bar sigma, and your function for your Gaussian would look like this. That's the function, that's the equation for a Gaussian. And so now, these two pieces give us enough that we can now fit our model to data. So when you combine a mean model like that with a noise model, you get a likelihood function. So you bring these two things together, and you get some p of y, which is the observed y, given theta, which these are the parameters of our model, the physical parameters in this case. And this would just be something like that right there. So this is something. Oh, well, we're almost there. So one thing that so this is the likelihood function for one data point, but thank goodness we generally have more than one data point because it would be pretty hard to fit a real model to just one data point in this case. And so I'll just index everything by n here. So we have n times, we have n fluxes, and we have n uncertainties on our fluxes. And when you have a set of measurements or a set of likelihood functions that you want to combine, there's only one thing you can do with them, and that's take the product. So we would put a product in front of here, and this. This gives us the full likelihood function for all of our data given the parameters theta. Okay? And so this is something that we now know how to operate on. So once we have some function that can compute this, we can plug it into a nonlinear optimizer or something like that to find the best fit values for theta or the maximum likelihood values for theta. Or we could multiply this by a prior on theta, and we could use Markov chain Monte Carlo to sample the posterior for those parameters. But really, sort of the fundamental object that's necessary when we're fitting a model to data is a likelihood function. Is everyone cool with that? Yeah.
I have a question. Doesn't this imply that your probability always goes down as you add more data points? Probability of your model being right?
Right. So this probability distribution right here it's not a probability distribution over models. So this is a probability distribution over data sets. And this is conditioned on n. So on the number of observations. So comparing likelihoods for data sets with different number of data points doesn't really make sense. You have to be somewhat careful when you do that. So another way of saying that is that in general, you don't want to you don't really care about the actual value of this likelihood, you only care about relative values. So all of the procedures for fitting theta here don't depend on the value, it only depends on the change in the value of the likelihood between different values of theta.
But it will also allow you to compare different models, so different functional forms for f.
That's also very subtle. We can talk about, we will come to that a little later. This likelihood function will be a central object in anything that you do to compare models, but it's not obvious that you can just use this directly.
You can compare the parameters of a given model.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so one sort of maybe technical point is that, like I said, you don't really care about the actual value of this, and most of the time, your models are so crap that this is zero. This is always zero. For any real data analysis problem, this is always zero to machine precision. Or infinity, so it's one of those. It's either zero or infinity. And so you never work with the probabilities directly. You always work with log probabilities. So I'll take the log of this. When you take the log of a product, you get a sum. So we're going to have a sum over data points. And then I'm going to pull the minus 1/2 out front. And inside of this sum, we have yn minus f theta of tn squared over sigma n squared plus log 2 pi sigma n squared. Okay, so this is, this right here is just the log of the expression that I have above. And there are a few things I want to notice here. So the first one is that this right here might be something familiar to folks. This is what we often refer to as chi-squared, or if we include the sum in it. This is what we would often refer to as chi-squared. And then this right here this might be a constant. In this particular case, this is a constant. And so I wanted to write this down this way because it's just to point out that minimizing chi-squared is the same as maximizing the likelihood under this very specific assumption about what the likelihood is, that the likelihood is Gaussian with known variances and independent noise between your data points. And so so I think it's worthwhile seeing that because, I mean, maybe you're, you know, maybe everyone knows this already, but sometimes it's useful to recognize that chi-squared that people use all the time, it can be derived this way. This is how you would come up with chi-squared as an objective to minimize. Any questions at this point? Cool. Okay, so I kept this term on because this term will become very useful as we go forward. But I just wanted to start with a simple example where so in this particular case I way overestimated my error bars. But you might have some reason to believe that your error bars are underestimated, and you want to fit for how underestimated those error bars are. So we're going to add a new parameter called S. That's just some excess jitter or excess variance that is the amount by which the error bars were underestimated. And if we do that, then we would end up with a new log likelihood that is now conditioned on S. And probably didn't need to write all of this out, but that's all right. And so this is what our likelihood would be if we wanted to fit for some excess variance say you're whoever did the data reduction didn't account for some missing noise or some piece in the error budget. And so this would let you fit for that. And in this case, the crucial point is that this term right here is no longer a constant. This term now depends on our parameters. So when you're comparing two different sets of parameters, you have to include this second term in it. And sort of qualitatively, why this term is useful is that if you only had chi-squared and you were trying to fit for S, making S bigger and bigger and bigger just always makes your model better, right? If S was infinity, then you'd have a perfect fit and the model would be very happy. Whereas this term prefers smaller S, and so these two terms trade off against each other, where this second term will try to make S as small as possible while still explaining the data properly. And so That's why it's crucial to include this second term if you're fitting for this parameter S.
Yeah. This is different than regularization, right? It has the same effect, but it's different. It's coming from wanting to model variance, extra variance.
This is not regularization in the sense that the way that I would normally phrase regularization is that it's a prior on the parameters S. So that's an equivalent way of writing that down. This is actually part of the likelihood. To get a properly normalized likelihood, you have to include this. So this is like this term is like a marginalized likelihood rather than a prior. We can chat about that if you'd like. But it will come up later again that this second term is the evidence integral of some likelihood function. So if you're familiar with model comparison by Bayes factors or evidence integrals, this term is one of those. In this case, it just happens to be a trivial one.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Well, I am fitting data to account for the fact that my error bars are too small. This is actually the normally way I do it, adding extra variance. But you can also do things like scaling your error bars. I think on your website that's the way you do it.
Sure. Yeah.
Are there any gotchas potentially with sort of using one or the other or something else in terms of accounting for extra noise?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I don't know that I have sort of specific comments to make for gotchas. But what I will say is that I would propose this as the simplest example of a Gaussian process. Mm-hmm. And so everything that I will talk about going forward, all of those gotchas and ideas for selecting the parameters and model comparison and stuff like that will also apply in this case. So maybe it's best to come back to that a little bit later. But in some sense, well, okay, no, I'll say that later. Any other questions? No? Okay, good. Let's see if there was anything else I wanted to. So just the last thing I was going to say is that something like this, or some scaling of the error bars, or something like that, is basically it. I would always include it in my modeling. It just adds one extra parameter. And it's going to make S as small as possible to still describe the data. So it really doesn't hurt you at all to include this. So it's just generally a good idea. And I would normally refer to this model as jitter. So I think that sort of the history of that is that it comes from radial velocity jitter, where there's some extra unaccounted for astrophysical variability that you want to try to capture using a parameter like that. And so basically, I would say you should always do something like this.
Is it correct to say, like in a chi-squared approach, that prevents you from getting a chi-squared less than 1? If your chi-squared were everything in the bracket rather than just the left side, you're sort of preventing the situation where...
Right. So not necessarily. That it still depends on this model might not be flexible enough to actually get to a chi-squared of 1,
oh, right?
Right? So... it's playing that role in that it's trying to keep the model as specific as possible while increasing the flexibility of the model to account for unmodeled uncertainty. But it's still conditioned on independent noise and just one extra parameter for increasing the variance and stuff like that. So it isn't necessarily going to do that, but it pulls in that direction. Any other questions? Great. Okay, so now I want to take this and I want to rewrite this in a different way. I don't know how familiar people are with their linear algebra. It might have been a few years since you've done that, but we're going down the linear algebra path now. And that's basically where we're going to be for the rest of the day. Okay, I can erase this. Okay, so what I want to do now in order to properly introduce Gaussian processes is I want to rewrite this as a matrix equation. And so to do that, I'm going to introduce two new symbols. So the first one is a vector, a residual vector called R. And it's going to be the, well, the residuals. So it's going to be y1 minus f at t1 up to yn minus f at tn. So that's the residual vector. And then the other thing that I want to have is I want to put in a covariance matrix, which is going to be a diagonal matrix with the uncertainties along the diagonal. And then zeros everywhere off the diagonal. And so here I've included the jitter term because I said that we should always do it, so might as well keep it here. And so then using these two things, I want to rewrite this equation right here. And so the first thing is, I don't know if you remember, but there, in linear algebra, you can take determinants of matrices, and that's a pain, but for diagonal matrices, it's pretty simple. So the determinant of C is just the product over the diagonal elements. So like that. And so the log determinant is the sum of the logs of the diagonal elements. So that's useful because that looks a lot like this term right here. And then C inverse, the inverse of a diagonal matrix, is a diagonal matrix where the elements along the diagonal are the inverses of the elements in the matrix. There's a lot of steps there. So this will be 1 over sigma 1 squared plus s squared to crucially, this is super not true for non-diagonal matrices. So you can't just, like, if you have a dense matrix with off-diagonal elements, you can't just take the inverse of all of the elements. I mean, our lives would be awesome if that was true, but it's not true. It's only true for diagonal matrices. But what this means is that we can rewrite our first term there as R, and I'm actually going to put a subscript theta on R just to remind ourselves that it's a function of the physical parameters. Remember, we have this transit model that we're putting into our data. R transpose C inverse R is equal to yn, the sum of yn minus ftn squared over sigma n squared plus s squared. And I'll leave it as an exercise to the reader to go through and make sure that that's right, but I promise it is. And that's useful because this looks a lot like our first term right here. And so we can put all this together to write down the matrix form of this equation right here. So now our log likelihood for all of our data y given theta and s is minus 1 half r theta transpose inverse r theta minus 1 half log determinant of c minus n over 2 log 2 pi. And there's the constant that Jim was talking about more obviously. You can see that as you get more data, this number gets more negative. So it goes down, and that's the scaling. And I promise that this expression right here is equal to this one right here. So I haven't made I haven't made any changes between these two. It's just a change of notation. So just as a reminder, this expression gives us the log likelihood for the data set that we've observed, conditioned on our mean model, which has a set of parameters, and our assumption that our noise model is Gaussian with independent error bars. So that's because we could take that product over data points. So this isn't a super rigorous proof, but trust me that this is the natural generalization of this equation right here as well, when we start to add off-diagonal terms in the covariance matrix C. So that's going to be our next step. Any questions about this jump right here? Okay, good stuff. So I think I had a few things I wanted to say about this before we go on any further. So the first thing is, again, this might not be very familiar, but this right here is the equation that you would get for an n-dimensional Gaussian. So if you like looked up multivariate Gaussian on Wikipedia, this is the equation that they would give more or less for, this is a normal distribution with mean F theta and covariance matrix C. And this is really the thing that that makes this is where Gaussian and Gaussian process comes from, is this multivariate Gaussian right here. That's a fact that is useful to know, perhaps. The other thing I wanted to say is that this is just, it looks kind of a little bit more heinous than what we had before, but in some sense, this is just a drop-in replacement for anywhere where you're using chi-squared right now. So you could just, plug this in and use this to fit your model to data. You could maximize this or minimize the negative of this, or multiply this by a prior and sample and all that kind of stuff. So there's nothing really fancy here. This is just a way of computing the likelihood of your data conditioned on some parameters. Good. So I've said a few times that our assumption sort of leading up to this, it was that our error bars and our noise model was independent. And the way that that's encoded in the way that I've written this is in the fact that all the off-diagonal terms of this covariance matrix are zero. And so what that means is that the covariance between, some data point 5 and data point 7 is exactly zero. So there can be no covariance between those data points in the noise model. And that's never true in practice. There's always some covariance because, your data sets are measured with the same instrument, or they were analyzed in such a way that you sort of detrended your data to remove systematic trends and stuff like that using your entire data set. Or there might be astrophysical sources of correlated noise where it's a rotating or oscillating star and neighboring data points, the values depend on each other because that's some physical system that's changing in a coherent way. So this, assuming that our off-diagonal elements are all zero, is a very strong assumption that most of the time is not justified. And so the whole thing with Gaussian processes is it's a way of adding off-diagonal elements to this matrix in, some tractable, perhaps understandable way. One thing that I wanted to emphasize at this point that I sort of blew past pretty quickly at the beginning is that I separated our model into two different parts. I have the noise model and the mean model. And the mean model, I said, is something that Eric taught us how to calculate in the context of of exoplanet transits. But really, there's a trade-off between those. There, at some level, you sort of get to choose what you put into the noise model and what you put into the mean model. And the real difference between those two is that the mean model is deterministic and the noise model is stochastic. And so if you have some deterministic way of computing what, you know, if you have a deterministic model for how the temperature of the Kepler spacecraft changes as a function of time, then you should put that into your mean model. And then your noise model will capture things that that you don't have a deterministic model for. Just one sec. So one other way of thinking about that is that, and this isn't sort of strictly right, but the noise model will often capture things where you don't care or don't know about the phase of the signal, whereas the mean model will incorporate things where you do know the phase of the signal. And we'll come back to that a little later. Phil?
That's kind of what I was going to ask about.
So yeah.
If you have a periodic noise,
mm-hmm.
where do you put it?
Yeah, so it depends a lot, right? So if you know the phase of that periodic signal, or that the phase is something that you're trying to measure, for example, with a transit or something like that, then you would put that into your mean model and you would marginalize over that. But you know, if you have a sinusoidal variations that are just superimposed on top of your signal, and you don't care what the phase of that is, and you want to marginalize over that phase, then you would incorporate that into the noise model.
Would you say that depends on how much you understand the physics of what's going on also?
Not necessarily.
What if you had something like Doppler beaming? Would you put mm-hmm. that into your mean model?
Totally, yeah. So in that case, you might know that the phase is related to some other phase in your model, or you might specifically care about that. But you might only care about the amplitude of your Doppler beaming, and then you could incorporate it into the noise model. So I think there can be a lot of trade-offs there that are sort of depend a little bit on the specific use case, but I don't think it's as cut and dry as what do you know the physics of and what you don't know the physics of. Good questions. Anything else? Good. Let's see, was there something else I wanted to say here? I have a rule of thumb: if you have a good deterministic model, put it in the mean. And so, there we go. So I've said that Gaussian process is all about putting off-diagonal elements in this matrix. This matrix has to be symmetric, but it has order n squared terms in it. So that means that if you were to fit for every element of this matrix, you would have far more parameters than you had data. That would get ugly pretty quickly. So instead, what you want to do is you want to try to write down some parametric form that describes how this matrix should be filled in. So to be a little bit more concrete, you would take this covariance matrix and you would rewrite it as a matrix that is, for reasons that might become clear later, called K a lot of the time, that has some new parameters alpha. And the elements of this matrix are sigma 1 squared plus S squared plus some small k that's a function of alpha of t1 t1. And then your next element would be k of alpha of t1 t2 all the way up to k alpha t
T1, Tn.
And so now, and we would sort of continue the pattern along here. So this would be K of alpha T2, T1. And down here we would have sigma n squared plus s squared plus k alpha tn tn. And so this is the way that we would fill in entries in this matrix, where we now have some function k that I'll talk about in a second that has some parameters alpha that describe the covariance between two different data points at, you know, ti, tj. Let's see, what can I do? So what it all comes down to is it comes down to figuring out how to write down this function right here. This function is referred to as the covariance function because it describes the covariance between two different points, or the kernel function for slightly more convoluted reasons. This is what Gaussian processes are all about, is this function right here. So when you fit chi squared, your kernel function is zero. So that's pretty easy. It's just zero. You could write the jitter term as s squared delta ij, because it's zero everywhere where I and j are not equal, and then s squared when they are equal. And so all of this can be kind of captured in this framework right here. Good. One other thing, so this let's see. So this has to be symmetric. So you can see, so this matrix K has to be positive definite and symmetric. So K T1 T2 has to be equal to K2 T1. There are various properties that this function has to satisfy. But as long as it satisfies those properties, then it's a valid covariance function. Now that we have this, we would rewrite our likelihood function over here, just swapping out C for K. But everything's all good. So this is still the likelihood function that we would use for evaluating the likelihood of our data under this Gaussian process model. And this is now also a function of alpha. And so alpha, these parameters right here, are often called hyperparameters. But they're not really different from theta. So we still do the same things to fit for alpha as we do to fit for theta. We just do it all together. So you would, you know, plug this into a nonlinear optimizer and you would fit for theta, s, and alpha all together. You have a couple more parameters, but you just evaluate this function and find the maximum. Or you would multiply by a prior on theta, s, and alpha, and you could sample in those parameters to marginalize over the posterior. There's nothing different about these parameters, even though they're called hyperparameters. There isn't anything different about them, except that they're parameters that parameterize the noise model, not the mean model. And so we're not as used to thinking about parameterizing the noise model as we are the mean model. So you know, so that's different. But what you actually do with them is no different. Similarly, if you know how to compare models, you know, doing some sort of, you know, Bayesian evidence integral calculations or something like that for different choices of mean model, you would just do the same thing for different choices of covariance model. And again, it's no different than how you would deal with parameters for the mean model. I'm going to talk about that more in a second, but at this point, I was just going to say, so this is it. We're essentially done. This is what Gaussian processes are. You write down a kernel function, and you do inference. You turn the inference crank, and you're all good. And you've dealt with your off-diagonal covariance between different data points and all that. So life's good. We should all just be using Gaussian processes all the time. But there, we're sort of left with two issues that I want to talk about. The first one is figuring out how to choose a kernel and some of the restrictions there, or covariance function. I just said that it's no different from the mean model, but you know, most of us are less familiar with parameterizing covariances, so it's worth talking about that. And then the other bit is computational cost. And this is because now, remember I mentioned that we couldn't compute the inverse of a matrix just by taking the inverse of its elements if it was a dense matrix. Now we have to actually invert an n by n matrix, which is outrageously computationally expensive in general. And so I want to talk about that as well. So those are sort of the two big limitations, or not big limitations, but the two big things that we need to talk about going forward. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was the choice of kernel functions. So
before,
yeah, please.
So the what if you have a situation where you knew that S depended on N, or you want S to change depending on like in rate of velocity of different instruments?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that correlate with what alpha is? So how would you handle that case?
Yeah, so in practice I would actually incorporate this into so my S's would be part of this. And it could be something like, you would have S A squared delta IJ and delta I A. So if the IF data point was measured with the AF instrument. And that's all consistent. You can fit for those parameters. Now, things might get a little tricky if you had one of these for every data point. And so in that case, you would have to put some sort of good prior on those, if you knew that there was a relationship between them or something like that. If you have a few different instruments with different jitters, then there's nothing wrong with doing that. And that's the important thing to point out is that this kernel function it can know about the identity of these times, right? So you might have correlated structure in one instrument where off diagonal elements are zero between different instruments, but non-zero within the same instrument, and so all that's fine. Sort of in execution, it can be a little tricky to do the bookkeeping, but in principle, there's nothing wrong with that. Anything else? Great. Okay, so I wanted to give a few pieces of advice about choosing your covariance function. And because this is something that always comes up when people are thinking about using Gaussian processes or hear a talk on Gaussian processes, there's always some discussion about this. And so the first thing to point out is that most of the time, your results will not be very sensitive to your specific choices about covariance function. So the actual details of how you assign these off-diagonal elements, as long as you make reasonable choices, in lots of cases, it's not going to make a huge difference. It will make a huge difference to include some parameterization for that. But as long as you make sensible choices, a lot of the time, those sensible choices are sufficient for what you need. But that's not always true. So we'll talk about some cases where that's not true. But an example of a sensible choice is one like this. So this is an example of a sensible choice. It looks a lot like a Gaussian. It's not a Gaussian. This has nothing to do with Gaussian processes. This is an exponential squared or a radial basis function or something like that, but it's definitely not a Gaussian, even though it looks like a Gaussian. So in this case, alpha has two parameters. It has a parameter A and a parameter L. And A sets the amplitude of the covariance. And it'll be in units of your of flux, in our case, your y units. And then L sets the correlation length. And so that'll be in units of your x-axis, or time, in our case. So sort of qualitatively, you might have some data that kind of look like that. And A would capture the amplitude of that covariance, and then L would capture this typical scale right here. So this is sort of a simple example of a covariance function that you might use that just has two parameters. You think that nearby data points are more correlated than data points that are far away, and that there's some representative scale over which that varies. So then you would throw that in. This is referred to with a few different names, never Gaussian, exponential squared, radial basis function, things like that. The other set of kernels to look at that also just have two parameters like this are the Matern kernels. They tend to be more popular than this kernel. I don't remember them off the top of my head, so I'm not going to write them down here. But the Rasmussen and Williams book has a list of all of the standard kernels, including the Matern kernels. So those are sort of the standard sensible types of kernels to use. An important thing to know is that if you have some valid kernel that satisfies the properties that are required for one of these, if you have two of them, then the sum and product of those are also valid kernels. So you can construct more complicated covariance functions by taking sums and products of simpler ones that you know are okay, and you know that you're still going to be fine using these more complicated kernels. So for example, one thing that came up was maybe there's some periodic component, and you know that there's some period in the data, and you want to incorporate that into your noise model. So another valid kernel is the cosine kernel. So you could multiply this by cosine of 2 pi ti stj over period. And so now we've added another parameter here. Now we would capture, this would be quasi-periodic variability. So there's some lifetime for the correlation on these periodic scales. So it's not strictly periodic necessarily, but the periodic variability will decay with some time scale L. A still sets the amplitude of the variability, and period is the underlying period of that variability. And so you can construct things like this to come up with some descriptive model for what the covariance should be.
So you said that these are valid kernels, which implies that you can't just make up a function yourself.
That's right. It
works. There's like a
So it has to be positive semi-definite, and exactly proving that can be a bit of a pain. Eric Eagle and I have spent some time thinking about that in some cases, and when you come up with a new kernel, you have some hoops to jump through. But the point is that there is a pretty flexible basis of known functions that you can use.
Yeah. So when I think about correlations between data, I usually parameterize it with a correlation coefficient, which can't be more than one. Data can't be more than 100% correlated. Mm-hmm. So does that place constraints on A in this? Because your off-diagonal, like the first K there, it can't be like positive semi-definite. It can't be larger than the square root of the diagonal L that's squared, because that would be a correlation coefficient greater than one.
Well, that would be A being sigma 1, sigma 2.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So do you have to force A? Do you have to place constraints? Well, if you do a fit, nonlinear fit, you let A move around.
Yeah.
Do you have to place some?
No. So a few things. So first of all, A, so if we put in Ti equals Tj, then this becomes A squared.
Right.
And so that's like just a jitter term that it's adding. So that's the noise parameter on the diagonal.
Oh, so that A is sigma squared.
Yeah. Normally I would add this. I would add sigma to that. So A would be like it would be the jitter component that was introduced by the correlated structure, and there's observational noise on top of that, which is parameterized by sigma. But in practice,
I see it's the plus. Okay, I see the plus sign.
Oh, yeah.
So by putting that plus sign there, you force the diagonal elements to always be larger than the sum of the square of the, or whatever. You force the condition that they're positive.
Right.
I didn't appreciate it.
But then the other point is that and this comes back to the earlier discussion, is that we have this log determinant term here. So in the case where we didn't have that, again, we would make A as big as possible, and our fit would get better and better and better. But the log determinant term is going to pull A to be as small as it can be, but still capture any correlated structure in the data. So that log determinant term is absolutely crucial if you're going to be fitting for the parameters of your kernel.
So A is like S in the previous.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And the exponential decays away. So generally, if you had zero noise, your off-diagonal components would be smaller. So if that exponential was replaced with a plus 1/2, then that would blow up, and that would be.
That's right. Yeah, there are probably some cases that we could come up with that would work, but it's a little subtle.
If we don't have a prior on L, are we assuming it's uniform, which would imply some special scale, or is the way it's written here it's scale free, so it's best just to keep it like this? Or do you want to add some prior, like P of L is 1 over L?
So that's a good question. So in practice, I would normally add that prior to make it uniform in log L. So that would add the preference that it wants small values of L, but But yeah, I don't know if I.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so, how will that this tend to behave if they're, let's say your sigma was really in reality was all that was there, and you just added this, but it wasn't necessary. What would you see L referring to do?
Right. Yeah. So. So it's a good question. For fixed A, I'm not sure. That's a good question. If you fit for A and L, if there's no correlated noise in the data, then A would go to zero and L would sample from whatever prior you'd chosen for it. But I don't actually know what the conditional distribution is, a condition on A.
Yeah, I don't know either. I suspect though that it would probably prefer a small L so that your covariance function would collapse to a diagonal so that the log determinant term would be as small as possible.
Yeah, I think that's probably
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, then it's like basically the same as diagonal.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah.
I suspect.
Yeah. Yeah?
Counter question to what you just said.
Yeah.
If you're using this model, you actually had no correlated noise, mm-hmm. but your error bars were wildly underestimated.
Yeah.
Then that would favor something with a small L but a big A, basically.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. So in practice, what I would do is I would still include that S from before because I said we should always do that. And so that would capture excess white noise. And then you would still have A going to zero, and everything would be
you
well
would
behaved.
Have an S term and an A term.
I would, yeah. So in practice, that's how I would do it. Yeah.
Are there any limitations on combining several different kernels together?
So there aren't in the sense that the log determinant term will try to make those as unimportant as possible, or as you know. As specific as possible. There will be computational issues, and you know, if you have more parameters, you know, optimizing for all of those or sampling for all of those can get more complicated. But in some sense, you know, putting, you know, if you have a few different kernels that you think might be good, taking the sum of the weighted sum of those with a prior. You know, it's sparsity prior or something like that is probably a great idea.
So, Rebecca mentioned a nice point which I had appreciated about making L scale free by putting whatever L is the prior.
Yeah.
Is there a similar argument for A?
So I would also do that for A because whenever I have a parameter that needs to be positive or has units, it tends to be better behaved when you have a log uniform prior on it. I'm sure there are more coherent arguments for that.
But in the absence of any, in the absence of any argument like that, that's the sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess in practice, if you're like using this in Monte Carlo markup chain, you could have your parameters be like log A.
Which they are by default.
Yeah, it depends on the implementation that you're using. But yeah, that's exactly right. So instead of putting in a different prior, you change the parameterization, so you're sampling in log A and log L. That's right, Becky.
So I'm enjoying the what ifs.
That's what we're here for.
You talked about two instruments. So suppose your HARP's north data is perfect, but your HARP's south data's got a lot of correlation.
Yeah.
Can you make the kernel a function, are you allowed to make the kernel a function of the diagonal element so it only kicks in this corner?
Yeah, so it
doesn't kick in this corner.
Yeah, so it wouldn't be a function of the diagonal elements. But it can be a function of these indices as long as it's symmetric. So in the case that you're talking about.
So if I is greater than j equals 10.
Yeah.
You're forced to be zero or something like that.
So what you would end up with is a block matrix like this, where your Harp's north data look great in diagonal and all that kind of stuff, and then this is a dense structure right here, you know. So that's totally fine as long as it's symmetric. So you would have trouble if you had sort of covariances only in one direction. But something like that, yeah, that's pretty common.
So that's a visual, but if the Harp's north and Harp's south data are at the same times.
Yeah. So there's in general there isn't any reason why it has to be sorted in this matrix. So I could come up with some sorting that would look like this. If you were trying to model astrophysical variability that's common between the different instruments that are at the same time, then exactly what this bit looks like is a little bit more complicated. Some, you know, whatever. There's structure in that part, but yeah, absolutely. But you can construct that, and you there's nothing wrong with using a kernel like that. Yeah. Cool. Okay. So you know, this might not, you know, this might not be super satisfying in that I've just kind of written down these, you know, some function, and I've asserted that it's something that'll work, and it sort of, you know, it sounds, you know, it has some of the parameters that you might care about, and it captures, it sort of tells the story that you might want to tell. But you still want to do sort of model checking and all that kind of stuff in the way that you would normally do when you're, you know, checking to make sure that your mean model makes sense and all of those kinds of things. But I was going to talk about one other thing, which is sometimes you actually do have physical models for the noise, and the astroseismologists in the room, in particular, are people who have a very good physical model for what this should look like. And I just wanted to write down a little sketch over here that I think is useful. So if we have, so here I'm really focusing on time series. The generalizations of this can be a bit tricky, but so if we have a time series and we take the Fourier transform of it, and this isn't going to be all super rigorous. This is sort of just a picture to think about, and a talking point perhaps. We have a time series, we take the Fourier transform of it, then we get the Fourier series. And then if we square the amplitudes of our Fourier series and throw away the phases, then we get the power spectrum. Now, if we take this same time series and we compute the autocorrelation of that time series, then we get the autocorrelation function. Again, when we compute an ACF, we're throwing away the phases in the data. And we take an ACF and we take the Fourier transform of it, we get the power spectrum. And so in practice, the key point is that both of these arrows go back and forth between each other. So you can go either direction. In these, there's no loss of information going between the top and the bottom. And so in practice, a lot of the time, to compute the ACF of a time series, people actually go this way. Because we know how to take fast Fourier transforms. So even if you don't necessarily think about it this way, you know, sometimes we use different corners of this graph right here. Now, the key point is that the ACF is the covariance function for a stationary process. And when I say stationary, I mean that K of alpha Ti Tj is equal to So the covariance only depends on the lags, so how far apart in time the different data points are. And so what this means is that if you have a model for the power spectrum, you can take the Fourier transform of that model, and you get a kernel function that you can use in a GP. And so what that means is that if you're used to modeling data in the Fourier domain, like astrosismology, for example, then the model that you're using in that space corresponds one-to-one with a model of the ACF that you could use to evaluate the likelihood of your time series given that same model. And that can be useful for various reasons that could be an interesting conversation of its own right at some point. But, you know, for example, you might have a better model of the systematics in the data in the time domain, or you might have some deterministic mean model like a transit that's superimposed on top of oscillations, and it's useful to have a realistic model for those oscillations while fitting for the parameters of your transit.
So you would suggest then that you could construct the kernel in a way that reflects what you know from astroseismology.
Exactly.
And then you might use some priors as well to maybe fit those parameters.
Exactly, yeah. So what I'm imagining is you write down, you know, your parameters are, you know, nu max and delta nu, and then you take the Fourier transform of your, you know, mixture of modes in the Fourier domain to get a kernel function, and then you compute the likelihood of the data given those parameters. So you would fit directly for those given the time series. That's right. Yeah?
Delta nu and max are good for some stars.
But yeah.
For the stars where we have 30 modes with three different angular degrees, we have mode splitting inclinations that link all the. How complicated would your kernel be?
Yeah. So I mean, so what? So that sounds great. I can't wait. Let's do it. So a few things to say. So, it would get complicated when you're there, but if you're fitting models like that in the Fourier domain, what I'm saying is that you could also be fitting those in the time domain, and if you were combining that with some detrending model or combining it with a transit model or something like that, then you might get a lot of power. You might get a much better constraint on the properties of your planet if you used, you know, the very flexible, you know, realistic model for the power spectrum.
But if you're only interested in the seismology, do you think you would gain if it's not a transit?
So I think we should have this conversation in more detail, because I think there are probably cases where it makes sense to work in one space or the other, and it probably depends on the details of the systematics and stuff like that.
I mean, I guess the question comes down to point B, which is the computational cost. I mean, I think in terms of like how to analyze the data, there's little to argue that you should work in the space where you know, in the time series.
Yeah.
It would make lots of, even for that's a just an oscillating star.
Yeah.
But the reason why as a community, if we're getting specific here now, did this in the power spectrum, we do it for so long, because it's just very fast to do it. But
That's exactly right, and so that's where we're going. Okay, so we got a little deep here. Any questions?
This might also be too detailed, but
no, that's
great. I have a question about like how these kernel functions, what they integrate to, because I guess what motivates me is, like, with Kepler data, you sometimes have both long and short cadence.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always, like, let them have their own noise parameters, but I know there's actually some relationship there.
Totally. That's great. So one thing that's really cool is that integration and differentiation are linear operators. So the integral of a Gaussian process is a Gaussian process where the kernel is an integral of the kernel for the original Gaussian process, and then same for differentiation. So you know, in principle, you can do all sorts of fun stuff to take that into account properly. In practice, or like in the specific context of Kepler short cadence data, it's not obvious how much you would gain from that, because probably most of the information that you get, there's probably so much data that you actually don't gain very much by including that relationship. But I'd be interested to look at sort of specific cases where it might benefit from that. But yeah, it's an interesting point that sort of, you know, a lot of the time we do observe integrals of some process that we care about, the actual underlying process. And so there are all sorts of interesting applications of that idea. Anything else about kernel selection? Okay, I'm just going to do 3 minutes on computational costs, and then I thought we were going to end way early, but you know, I can ramble on for hours. Sorry. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was computational cost. Second to last thing I wanted to talk about was computational cost. So I mentioned this briefly already, but the reason why not everyone in the room immediately put up their hand and said that they use Gaussian processes is that actually evaluating this function can be very computationally brutal. So you need to compute the log determinant and solve this system or compute the inverse of this matrix K. And this matrix is n by n, where n is the number of data points that you have. So, and the way that this is normally done is by using the Cholesky factorization of this matrix. So you would compute how to factor this into the product of two lower triangular matrices. And then using these lower triangular matrices, you can evaluate the determinant and this right here very efficiently. And so this is the standard way that that's done. But figuring out what L should be given some K, the computational cost of that scales as n cubed. So as you get more data, or as your matrix gets bigger, it gets a lot more computationally expensive to do this. So in sort of using just standard naive methods, or not naive, but like sort of standard state-of-the-art methods to brute force this calculation, you know, you're limited to less than 1,000 data points, basically. Because it's going to take a few seconds to evaluate this and a huge amount of RAM, and then you have to do it inside of a optimization loop or MCMC or something like that. And so it quickly becomes totally intractable. Now, the test short cadence data, N is about 20,000. That'll take on my laptop or something like that, even using multiprocessing, you know, this is going to take 45 minutes to just evaluate the system once. And probably I'd run out of RAM. It's just not tractable to do something like this in a lot of real cases that we care about. A few things. So first of all, this right here is linear algebra. It's just linear algebra, and linear algebra is super useful. It's very interesting. So there's a lot of research in applied math into linear algebra. But then there's also a lot of investment because, say, deep learning, for example, is just linear algebra. So Google cares a lot about making linear algebra fast. So there's a whole lot of work that's been done in trying to make these types of calculations more tractable, even for huge data sets. There are a few different ways of making this tractable So the first one is to subsample your data. This is sort of the classic way of doing it. You just take every hundredth data point and fit your model using those. Or there are sort of more rigorous ways of doing that and propagating information properly. But that sort of, and the thing that's nice about subsampling is that in that case, n cubed really helps you. Because if you throw away, if you only take every hundredth data point, you get a huge gain in computational cost because of that n cubed. But, you know, it's not, whatever. So then there are also approximate methods. Let's save those in a second. So the second option, that should probably be the first option, is get a better computer. I'm not totally kidding, and this one can help all the other methods as well, because linear algebra libraries can use GPUs, they can use multiple threads, all that kind of stuff. So you can get a lot of performance improvement from using state-of-the-art hardware, and there's been a lot of work in optimizing all these methods for good hardware, especially GPUs recently. Okay, so then approximate methods. This in an approximate method, you might write down some. That's not how you spell it. You come up with some way of evaluating all the things that you care about approximately, and you might be able to do that scalably. And then the last way is to use structure. So if you have evenly sampled data or something like that, then you can solve these systems using fast Fourier transforms. There are all sorts of different structures that you can take advantage of to get fast computation. And these two are actually very related to each other because approximate methods often try to approximate your covariance matrix as a structured matrix that you can then apply fast computations to. So for example, you might approximate your matrix as an interpolated matrix, but that it's on a very finely sampled, evenly sampled space. And then you can use that structure to get fast solves.
So I'm guessing a lot of the time your elements that are far off the diagonal are very small, because data points widely separated in time aren't correlated.
Yep.
So are there ways to take advantage of
totally. Yeah, so that's a good point. I didn't include that in here. I don't know where that would be. Let's put it here.
Structure.
You're right.
Yeah, like a diagonal, or an almost diagonal matrix that I know you can solve faster.
There's been a lot of work in sparse linear algebra. So if you know in advance that certain elements in your matrix are definitely going to be zero or close enough that you don't care, then you can exploit that structure. In my experience, I haven't had a lot of luck with methods like that because most of the problems that I'm working on, if I care about using a GP, the correlation lengths are strong enough or long enough, or I don't know them in advance. So I haven't had a huge amount of success with that, but I think that's a good thing to include. So for structure, I wanted to bring up one second. So there's this fairly new package called Celeri Te that I wrote with Eric and Ruth, who's also around. And it does order n exact evaluations of this Gaussian process likelihood. So instead of n cubed, we get order n. And the thing that's nice about it, but you're restricted to a specific type of kernel. So it needs to be 1D stationary kernels of a specific form. But the thing that's nice about that form is that the kernel is a sum of stochastically driven damped simple harmonic oscillators. So it's exactly what you would want if you were doing astroseismology, for example. So with this, you know, I can evaluate, you know, models with test scale data with no problem. You know, it takes a fraction of a second, just on my laptop. So so this, if you have a 1D problem, then basically this is kind of the go-to that I would say these days. I had one other thing I wanted to say about this. So the computational cost also scales poorly with the number of simple harmonic oscillators. So it scales as the square of the number. So in Mikkel's case, you know, the computational cost is starting to get a little bit uglier. But I think we can still do things to make it work. So there are limitations in that sense. But if you only have one, for example, the computational cost is about a factor of 2 the computational cost of just computing chi-squared. So we're getting to the point where this is, like, everyone should be doing this if you have a 1D problem.
In particular, how is the acceleration obtained in the case of celerity?
Yeah, sure. I think that's beyond the scope. It's mostly magic.
You forgot the fourth author in the paper.
Yeah.
Magic, Sivaram, yeah. Ambikasaran figured out a way to Jalevsky decompose a matrix that's composed of the sum of simple harmonic oscillator kernels with a really clever
It's ridiculous. I mean, the whole thing, like, the whole algorithm is like 5 lines of code. And it's just recognizing that there's a lot of structure in that matrix that you can take advantage of. It's more general than just these simple harmonic oscillators. We don't have good examples yet, I think, of other use cases. I'm sure it's applicable in other places that are worth thinking about. So the last thing, I know that we're going way over, but I just wanted to say one last practical thing, which is, I mentioned celerite, but if you want to actually use Gaussian processes, first of all, it's actually, you know, it's not too painful to just compute this, like, you know, in whatever programming language you use, it probably has linear algebra operations. You can solve this system and compute the determinant, and so it's actually not too bad to just write this down. But there are lots of packages that exist for, like, trying out different kernels and getting these accelerated solvers and stuff like that. So I just wanted to list a few. So celerite was one. And I'd be happy to chat with you if you're interested in using that. And then another one that I wrote is George. And that's useful because it has sort of lots of kernels. It works in arbitrary numbers of dimensions. But it's slow in the sense that it scales as n cubed in most cases. So it could be good for testing if you have a small data set and just sort of playing around with things. But it won't scale to really big problems. The last one that I wanted to mention is something called GPyTorch that just came out fairly recently. And I actually haven't used it. But it seems awesome. It uses GPUs. It uses approximate methods. It's sort of scalable in arbitrary numbers of dimensions. It sort of seems too good to be true, so I think it would be interesting to try it out on some astronomy applications. And I know the developers pretty well, so I'm they'd be really excited to do some astronomy. So if people want to try it out, I find the documentation a little bit hard to parse, but I would be pretty excited to try it out if you have a problem that would be useful in this using code like this. Good. So that's all I wanted to talk about today. Thanks.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah. Thank you.
possibly. I have some follow-up questions.
We can chat over lunch.
So why this called Gaussian processing?
Say again?
Why does this call Gaussian processing?
Oh, yeah. Partly because of this. So this is a big Gaussian. And the fact that it's a process is a bit more convoluted.
Gaussian is allowing you to have angle, right?
So the Gaussian part is that you're saying that your likelihood function is fully specified by the first and second moments. So it's just you have a mean and a covariance, and it's a Gaussian. So that's where the Gaussian part comes from. The fact that it's a process is because if you have a kernel function, a continuous kernel function, then you actually have a probability distribution over functions, which is not always useful to think about. But that's where that comes from.
So, to extend that, in the same way, you could write down a Lorentzian process.
You could, but Gaussians are so much better than every other distribution.
I'm not saying you should. Yeah.
But yes, you can. Yeah, you can write down all sorts of different processes.
Yeah. So that may help with outliers, actually. Yeah. So you're not thinking about that.
Exchange T is often used.
Yeah. So student's T is one limited, but it's just a Lorentzian.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Exactly.